A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and I have to admit, I did not expect to be sitting here genuinely excited to discuss paint markers. But here we are. He's preparing to move apartments, and in the process of organizing his home office, he started labeling inventory with paint markers, cables, equipment, the works. He built up a whole kit. Different tip sizes, silver and gold markers, the works. And what he noticed was that this process of writing tiny inventory IDs on different surfaces felt weirdly engrossing. He's asking whether he accidentally stumbled into an amateur form of art therapy, even though there's nothing particularly creative about what he's doing.
I love this question because it gets at something that I think a lot of people experience but don't have the language for. That feeling of getting completely absorbed in a task that is, on paper, utterly mundane. You're just writing numbers on cables. But it feels good.
And I should say, I've now seen some of these labeled cables, and the lettering is impressive. There's a precision to it. Silver ink on a dark braided cable jacket. These tiny, neat identifiers. It looks intentional in a way that regular labeling does not.
That's the personal story. But what does the science actually say about why this feels so good? Let's dig into the neuroscience.
Before we go there, let me frame what I think the core question actually is here. Can a task be therapeutic without being artistic? Because what Daniel's describing doesn't fit the traditional definition of art therapy at all. There's no emotional expression, no creativity, no interpretation. Nobody's going to hang a labeled power brick on a gallery wall and ask what the artist was feeling when he wrote PSU-14 in gold.
Although I would attend that gallery opening.
Of course you would. But the point stands. This is pure precision and order. It's the opposite of expressive art. And yet the psychological effect he's describing sounds therapeutic.
Let's define what we're actually talking about here. Art therapy, as a clinical practice, is a credentialed mental health profession. The American Art Therapy Association defines it as using active art making, the creative process, and applied psychological theory within a psychotherapeutic relationship. The key phrase there is, within a psychotherapeutic relationship. It's facilitated by a trained therapist. What Daniel is doing is what the field calls therapeutic art making outside a clinical context that nonetheless provides psychological benefits.
That distinction matters, because it means we're not making a clinical claim here. We're talking about something more accessible, something you stumble into while packing boxes.
And the research on therapeutic art making is actually quite robust. A 2021 study in Frontiers in Psychology found that just 15 minutes of repetitive fine motor activity, in this case, coloring mandalas, reduced cortisol levels by 28% compared to unstructured free drawing. 28%. That's not trivial.
So you're telling me that the time it takes to label a drawer full of cables could measurably reduce stress hormones?
That's what the data suggests. And the mechanism here isn't about artistic expression. The mandala study specifically compared structured coloring to free drawing. The structured condition produced the cortisol reduction. The free drawing didn't, which suggests the benefit is coming from the structure, not the creativity.
That's counterintuitive. Most people assume the therapeutic part of art is self-expression, getting your feelings out onto the canvas.
That can be therapeutic, absolutely. But that's not what's happening with the cable labeling. What's happening there is something different. It's about entering a specific cognitive state. And I think the best framework for understanding this is flow.
The guy with the unpronounceable name who spent his career studying why some activities feel intrinsically rewarding.
Pronounced chick sent me high, for the record. And his original 1975 study identified three necessary conditions for flow: clear goals, immediate feedback, and a balance between perceived challenges and perceived skills.
Let's map those onto cable labeling, because I think it's almost absurdly perfect. You know exactly what you're doing. This cable needs an identifier. The moment the marker touches the surface, you see the line. You know if it's clean or if it's smudged. The result is right there.
The challenge skill balance is where it gets interesting. If you're using a cheap ballpoint on a flat piece of paper, there's no challenge. It's boring. But writing tiny letters with a paint marker on a curved rubber cable jacket? That requires actual fine motor control. You have to manage pressure, angle, drying time. It's just difficult enough to engage you without being frustrating.
Assuming you have the right marker for the surface, which is where the kit comes in.
We'll get to the kit. But first, let me geek out about what's actually happening in the brain during this kind of task, because it's fascinating.
This is why we keep you around.
Fine motor control, which is what you're using when you're writing tiny letters on a curved surface, activates a whole network of brain regions that are largely dormant when you're typing or scrolling. Your premotor cortex is planning the movements. Your cerebellum is coordinating the precise muscle activations. And your basal ganglia are heavily involved in selecting and refining motor patterns.
The basal ganglia. Those are the structures deep in the brain that I vaguely remember from somewhere.
Here's a wild fact. The basal ganglia consume approximately 20% of the brain's energy, despite comprising only 2% of its volume. They're metabolic powerhouses, and they're heavily activated during fine motor tasks. When you're writing with a 0.7mm paint marker on a curved surface, you are lighting up these ancient, energy-hungry brain structures in a way that scrolling through email simply does not do.
Part of what feels good might literally be that we're using parts of our brain that are starved for engagement in modern life.
That's a reasonable hypothesis. We evolved to use our hands for precise, feedback-rich tasks. Tool use, crafting, writing. And now most of us spend our days making small thumb movements on glass. The neural circuitry for fine motor control is still there, and it wants to be used.
Like adopting a feral cat.
I'm not sure that analogy holds, but I appreciate the attempt.
You feed it. It keeps coming back. Your basal ganglia get a taste of actual fine motor work, and suddenly spreadsheets feel inadequate.
There's also the dopamine loop of completion. This is something that gets discussed a lot in productivity contexts, but the neuroscience is solid. Each time you complete a discrete task, your brain releases a small amount of dopamine. It's a reward signal. And labeling inventory produces an almost perfect sequence of these micro-completions.
Each label is a finished unit. You write it, you look at it, it's done.
Versus email, where you answer one and three more appear. Or Slack, which is an infinite scroll of partial attention demands. The labeling task has what behavioral psychologists call high task closure. You can see the drawer of labeled cables and know exactly what you accomplished. There's no ambiguity.
There's an aesthetic dimension here that I don't think we should gloss over. The prompt specifically mentions silver and gold markers on dark surfaces. That's not just functional. That's a deliberate aesthetic choice.
And there's research on this too. The visual system responds differently to high contrast stimuli. Silver and gold on dark backgrounds create what's sometimes called the Goldilocks effect of visual contrast. It's not the harsh black on white that we're used to reading all day. It's something that feels special.
It elevates the task. You're not just labeling, you're inscribing.
That elevation matters psychologically. If you're using a silver marker on a black cable, the result looks intentional. It looks designed, even if you're just writing HDMI3. The medium itself signals that this object matters.
There's also the IKEA effect at play here. We value things more when we put effort into them. The classic study by Norton, Mochon, and Ariely found that people were willing to pay significantly more for furniture they assembled themselves than for identical pre-assembled furniture. The act of building it created a sense of ownership and value.
Labeling is a form of that. You're not building the cable, but you're inscribing it into your system. You're making it yours. A cable with a handwritten gold label is a cable that belongs to someone who cares.
Versus the cable sitting in a tangled drawer that might as well be anyone's. It's anonymous. Labeling de-anonymizes the object.
Which connects to something I want to dig into more. The psychological difference between passive consumption and active engagement with your physical environment. But let's hold that thought, because I think we need to talk about the knock-on effect here. The prompt mentions that this labeling process was part of preparing for a move. And in the process of labeling everything, he ended up discarding about 30% of the inventory. That's not a side note. That's a major psychological benefit.
Because labeling forces you to handle every single item. You can't label a cable without picking it up, looking at it, and deciding what it is. And in that moment, you also decide whether you actually need it.
This is what Marie Kondo gets right, even if the spark joy language can feel a bit precious. The act of physically handling each possession forces a decision, keep or discard. And that decision-making process, when applied systematically, reduces cognitive load.
There's a concept in environmental psychology about visual clutter and cognitive load. The basic idea is that every object in your visual field demands a tiny amount of attentional processing. A messy desk is literally cognitively draining because your brain is constantly registering and categorizing all those objects in the periphery.
Unlabeled, unorganized cables are the worst version of this. They're ambiguous. You don't know what they go to. You don't know if they work. You don't know if you still own the device they connect to. Each one is a tiny unresolved question sitting in a drawer.
A drawer full of existential uncertainty.
I was going to say a drawer full of open cognitive loops, but yes, existential uncertainty works too, and labeling closes those loops. Once a cable has an identifier, it's no longer ambiguous, it's known, it's part of the system.
Which brings me to something I want to examine more carefully. The paradox of productive procrastination. Because let's be honest, spending hours labeling cables when you should be packing boxes and coordinating movers, that looks like procrastination.
It might be, but not all procrastination is equal. There's a difference between doom-scrolling social media to avoid packing and doing detailed organizational work that produces a lasting benefit.
The prompt describes this really well. The labeling felt like work, but served as a break from more stressful moving tasks. It was a psychological buffer, a way to be productive while also giving yourself a break from the stressful stuff.
I think that's actually a healthy coping mechanism. Moving is one of the most stressful life events. There's research ranking it right up there with divorce and job loss in terms of psychological impact. Having a task that lets you feel competent and in control during a period of chaos, that's valuable.
Control is the key word there. Moving makes you feel out of control. There are 1,000 variables, most of which you can't manage. But labeling cables? That's a domain where you have total control. You decide the system. You execute it. You see the results.
That sense of control is psychologically protective. There's a whole literature on locus of control and stress resilience. When people feel they have agency over some part of their environment, they cope better with stressors in other parts of their life.
We've established this is real and it works. Let's talk about the kit, because the prompt mentions building up a collection of markers, and I think that's actually central to the experience, not a side detail.
Oh, the kit is absolutely central. Tool selection as a satisfying meta task. I've seen this in so many domains. Photographers obsessing over lenses, programmers customizing their text editors. The process of researching, selecting, and curating tools is itself a source of engagement and satisfaction.
With paint markers specifically, the selection process is complex. You're dealing with tip size, 0.7 millimeters versus 1.0 millimeters. You're dealing with ink chemistry, oil-based versus water-based versus acrylic. You're dealing with surface compatibility. What works on PVC cable jackets versus rubber versus braided nylon?
The global industrial marker market was valued at $2.3 billion in 2025, with paint markers growing at 8.7% compound annual growth rate. This is not a niche hobby. This is a massive market driven partly by industrial applications, but increasingly by DIY and home organization.
$2.3 billion for markers. That's a lot of people writing on things.
The brand differentiation is real. Edding 7AD versus UniPosca versus Sharpie Pro. These are not interchangeable products. Each has specific characteristics. The Edding 7AD, for instance, is engineered for industrial environments. It can survive temperatures up to 400 degrees Celsius. That's completely unnecessary for labeling a USB cable in a home office, but there's something deeply satisfying about using a tool that is over-engineered for the task.
It's the glockenspiel of corporate approachability. No, wait, that's all right. It's more like using a professional chef's knife to chop vegetables for a weeknight dinner. Is it necessary? Does it make the experience better?
The ritual of tool selection primes the brain for focused engagement. This is something that shows up in research on mindfulness and preparation. The act of selecting the right marker for the surface, testing it on a small area, adjusting your grip, all of that is a transition ritual. It signals to your brain that you're entering a focused state.
There's also the sensory pleasure of the tools themselves. The weight of a good marker, the way the cap clicks into place, the smell of the ink. These are all sensory inputs that contribute to the experience.
The range of colors. The prompt specifically mentions silver and gold, which are not typical labeling colors. Most industrial labeling is black on white or white on black. Silver and gold are aesthetic choices. They serve no additional functional purpose, but they make the result look beautiful.
Which loops back to the dopamine hit. If you're going to look at that label every time you reach for a cable, making it look good is not frivolous. It's an investment in future micro moments of satisfaction.
This is where I want to draw a comparison to the bullet journal phenomenon, because I think there's a parallel. Bullet journal enthusiasts often spend more time setting up their system than actually using it. The elaborate spreads, the color coding, the perfect lettering. And people mock this. They say it's performative productivity, but I think that misses the point.
Because the setup itself provides disproportionate satisfaction.
The act of creating the system is satisfying in a way that using the system often isn't. And that's not a failure. That's a feature. The setup is a creative, fine motor, feedback-rich activity. The daily logging is just writing down what you did.
The therapeutic value comes from the structure, not the content, which is the opposite of traditional art therapy.
That's the insight I want to land. Traditional art therapy is about content. What are you expressing? What emotions are coming through? What does this image mean to you? What Daniel is describing is about structure. It's therapeutic not because it expresses something, but because it organizes something.
That organizing happens both externally and internally. You're organizing your cables, but you're also organizing your attention. For that 30 minutes or hour, everything is orderly. Everything has a place. Everything makes sense.
There's a Zen concept that feels relevant here. The idea that everyday activities, done with full attention, are a form of meditation. You don't need to sit on a cushion and focus on your breath. You can focus on the tip of a paint marker as it traces a letter on a curved surface. Same cognitive mechanism.
I want to push on something, though, because I can imagine a listener thinking, great, so now I need to buy a 12-marker paint kit and label all my possessions to feel better? That feels like a lot.
No, and that's not the point. The point is to recognize that these opportunities for what I'll call microflow experiences already exist in your life. You just might not be noticing them. Or you might be dismissing them as chores.
Give me some examples beyond labeling.
Data cleaning is a big one. People who work with spreadsheets often report that the process of finding and fixing errors, standardizing formats, deduplicating entries, it's deeply satisfying in the same way. Clear goals, immediate feedback, visible results. Sorting Lego by color, organizing a bookshelf. These are all tasks that combine fine motor control, clear completion criteria, and visible transformation.
Sharpening knives is a good one. There's a whole subculture of people who are weirdly into whetstone sharpening. Hours of YouTube content, forums debating grit progression. And the result is just a sharp knife, which you could achieve with a $10 pull-through sharpener.
It's not about the result, it's about the process. The ritual of soaking the stone, finding the angle, feeling the burr form, testing on paper. It's a flow experience disguised as a chore.
The framework is, identify tasks in your own life that combine fine motor control, clear completion criteria, and visible results. Those are your microflow opportunities.
Invest in the tools. I think this is important. If you're going to sharpen knives, get a decent whetstone. If you're going to label cables, get paint markers that work on the surfaces you're labeling. The ritual of tool selection primes the brain for focused engagement, and using quality tools makes the experience more satisfying.
The prompt mentions experimenting with different markers to find what works on different surfaces. That experimentation is part of the flow. You're not just labeling. You're learning about materials and adhesion and tip flexibility. You're developing expertise in a tiny domain.
Developing expertise is intrinsically rewarding. There's research on this in the context of hobby engagement. People who develop what's called serious leisure, hobbies where they build genuine skill and knowledge, report higher life satisfaction than people who engage in purely passive leisure.
I like that. Cable labeling as serious leisure.
It sounds absurd when you say it out loud, but the psychological mechanism is the same as someone who restores vintage motorcycles or builds model ships. It's a domain of focused skill development with visible results.
There is a tipping point, though. The prompt doesn't mention this, but I think it's worth discussing. When does this stop being therapeutic and start being frustrating?
That's important. The flow state depends on the challenge skill balance. If the challenge exceeds your skill, you get anxiety, not flow. So, if you're trying to label a surface that the marker won't adhere to, or the tip is too broad for the space, or the ink smudges because you didn't wait long enough, that's not therapeutic. That's just annoying.
Smudging is the enemy of flow.
Smudging is absolutely the enemy of flow. And hand cramps. If you're gripping a tiny marker for 2 hours, your hand will eventually tell you to stop. Part of the skill development is learning your limits.
There's a sweet spot. Enough challenge to engage, not so much that it frustrates. The right tools for the service. A clear system, so you're not constantly second-guessing your own labeling scheme.
That's where the kit comes back in. Having the right tool for each surface means you're not fighting the materials, you're working with them. The marker glides, the ink adheres, the line is clean, that's the flow state.
I want to zoom out for a moment and think about what this tells us about modern life more broadly. Because I think there's something here about the kinds of activities that our current environment makes available to us, and the kinds it doesn't. Most of us spend our days in digital environments. These are low-fidelity motor actions with ambiguous feedback. Did that email actually resolve anything? Is that Slack thread done? The feedback loops are broken. The completion signals are missing. And then we stumble into a task like labeling cables, where the feedback is immediate and the completion is unambiguous and it feels like a revelation.
We're starved for closure. That's the phrase I'd use. Digital work environments are designed to never be done. The inbox is never empty for long. The notification queue refills. There's always another thing, and our brains did not evolve for that. We evolved for tasks with clear endpoints. The antelope is caught. The fire is built. The basket is woven.
The cable is labeled.
The cable is labeled. And you can look at it and know, with absolute certainty, that this task is complete. That's a rare feeling in 2026.
The question becomes, can you deliberately engineer these moments? Can you build microflow into your life in a way that's sustainable?
I think you can, and I think the framework is actually quite simple. 1. Does this task require my hands to do something precise? 2. Can I tell immediately whether I did it well? 3. Will I be able to see the result when I'm done?
That's a good filter. And it explains why so many people find cooking satisfying in a way that ordering takeout isn't. Precise knife work, immediate feedback from the sizzle in the pan, a visible result on the plate.
Or, yes, labeling cables with paint markers. These are all tasks that meet those criteria.
They're all tasks that have been partially displaced by convenience. We don't need to cook. We don't need to garden. We don't need to write by hand. But maybe we need to, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. The psychological benefits don't disappear just because the task is no longer strictly necessary. The benefits are intrinsic to the activity, not the utility of the outcome.
The actionable takeaway for anyone listening is, don't dismiss boring organizational tasks as chores. Reframe them as opportunities for deliberate practice in precision and presence.
Invest in the tools. Not because you need the fanciest marker on the market, but because the act of selecting and caring for tools is part of the psychological benefit. It signals to your brain that this matters.
Look for the tasks in your own life that combine fine motor control, clear completion criteria, and visible results. You probably already have some. You just might not have noticed them.
Or you might have been outsourcing them, paying someone else to do the thing that would actually make you feel better if you did it yourself.
That's a counterintuitive idea. That some of the chores we pay to avoid are actually psychologically beneficial.
Not all chores. I'm not going to argue that scrubbing toilets is therapeutic. But tasks that require skill, that produce visible transformation, that have clear completion, those are different. Those are worth keeping.
I want to return to something the prompt mentions near the end. The idea that some of the markings are rather delightful. There's pride there. Genuine pride in having developed a skill.
That pride is earned. It's not delusional. If you've spent hours learning to write tiny, neat letters on curved rubber surfaces with a paint marker, you have developed a real skill. It's a small skill. It's not going to get you a job. But it's real, and the satisfaction is real.
I think that's where we should leave this. The recognition that these small, seemingly mundane skills are genuine accomplishments. They're not a waste of time. They're not procrastination, or at least not just procrastination. They're a way of engaging with the physical world that our digital lives have largely eliminated.
As remote work continues to blur the line between home and office, the rituals we build around our physical spaces may become more important for mental health, not less. Your home office isn't just where you work. It's an environment you can shape, organize, and care for. Labeling your cables is part of that.
The question I want to leave listeners with is this. If we can find genuine therapy in labeling cables, what other mundane tasks are we overlooking as sources of psychological benefit? What's the equivalent in your life? Maybe it's organizing your tools. Maybe it's arranging your books. Maybe it's something you've been dismissing as a weird little habit that actually serves a real purpose.
Pay attention to the things you do that feel good for reasons you can't quite explain. There's probably a neuroscience paper somewhere that backs you up.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1970s, a team of geologists in Bhutan reported discovering extensive fulgurite formations, glass tubes created when lightning strikes sand, at an elevation of 14,000 feet. The discovery was celebrated internationally until a follow-up expedition in 1979 determined the formations were actually ancient glass-making waste from a medieval monastery kiln. The monks had been recycling bottles for centuries and dumping the slag behind the workshop.
Recycling glass before it was cool.
I'd read that paper.
This has been my Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for making this show possible. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps other people find the show. We're at My Weird Prompts. Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My Weird Prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My Weird Prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.